Welcome back to Career Explorers. It's the podcast where we talk with folks living and working in a career that you might want to explore. You know, maybe you're a student looking for your first time career, or maybe you're already in one and you're kind of considering making the jump. The career we have today is really something special because I think there are those of us that might take for granted, maybe, each and every day having two arms, two legs, feet, and hands. And there's reasons, whether, you know, it's by disease or through warfare or even something like an automobile accident, that we can lose those limbs. And if you're someone truly dedicated to helping people in what I can only describe as one of their most life-changing medical events, you might want to consider being an orthotist and prosthetist and help those same people regain their lost mobility. With me today is Olivia Slaughter from Real Life Prosthetics in Abingdon, Maryland. Olivia, thanks so much for coming on to Career Explorers.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to dive into this here. So just tell me a little bit about your journey into the prosthetic world. I always begin with asking this because it's different and it's unique for everybody. So maybe just kind of give me give me your story. What sparked your personal interest in getting into this field?
Sure. So I grew up in a household where we worked on kind of everything that we wanted to do. So my dad had a lot of hobbies outside, and we grew up on dirt bikes and gasoline powered things, and if you broke it, you had to fix it. So did a lot of things with tools with him, and learned kind of my way around a garage and that. And then my mom is a nurse, so I saw the medical side of stuff and I wanted to explore that more. So when I was in sixth grade, I read a book about a boy with bacterial meningitis called Up and Running, is the name of the book, and it details his process of getting prosthetics, and I thought, wow, man, that's a good field. It's a good mix of both things that I really like to do.
And from there, it just kind of, it coalesced into this. I'm totally seeing it. It developed from a young age, it sounds like.
I think that was in like sixth grade. I read that book and kind of stuck with it ever since then.
Wow. So some childhood influences there for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
So let's say, you know, I'm considering this field, right, as my profession. You know, what does my background look like? Do I jump right in and start learning? How much education would I need?
So the linguistics or the terms in this field are a little confusing. So yeah, I'll clear that up too. So the field as a whole, it's two separate fields actually. One is prosthetics and one is orthotics, prosthetics being the artificial limbs and orthotics being bracing. So then that's the field. And then the devices for the two are called either a prosthesis or an orthosis, or the singular term or plural term. You know, you can mix it up with the S's on the ends.
Sure.
But then the practitioner for the field would be a prosthetist or an orthotist.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. How much training do I need? Can people learn on the job? I mean, is this 4-year?
Sure. Yeah. So in about 2008, the field shifted. I heard this term actually from my alma mater, for the University of Pittsburgh, and they said, for this field, you have to think like an engineer and execute like an artist. So
wow.
That kind of displays the background that people come from. It's a wide variety, but typically people will get some sort of bachelor's degree in a medical science related field. I had classmates who were from an engineering background. I myself have a degree in kinesiology, so exercise science. So a 4-year degree, and then you go to a master's program for orthotics and prosthetics. Again, in 2008, they made that a requirement for a master's.
Okay.
Again, the field is separate, and the testings are for two separate certifications, but the master's program includes both disciplines. So you get your master's degree in 2 years after your bachelor's, and then you have to do a residency. So again, back to the two-field thing, you can do an 18-month combined residency and then sit for your board exams, or you can do two separate one-year residencies per discipline.
So it's going to take a couple of years.
Yeah.
You just don't walk in and you don't start learning. It's going to take some time.
Definitely.
You know, to get this mastery of this.
Yeah.
And I loved what you said there. Half artistry, half engineering. I mean,
yep.
Wow, my brain just went, you know, that's two different worlds, you know, kind of living in harmony right
yes,
there.
Definitely.
And I want to ask this next question, because this is something here at WHFC that we always tell the students: intern early, intern often. How big a role are internships in this field?
Very big. So the field has a lot of hand tool requirements, where you have to use tools to fix, manufacture people's devices. And with that in mind, you have to get familiar with those tools. Some of them are very unique to the field. We have something called a Troutman router. It's very standard. Any office you walk into, you'll find yourself a Troutman router. But before that, or anyone else, has never heard of a Troutman router. So
this is my first time.
Right. So you have to familiar yourself with the tools, and the master's programs require internship hours. Since I went to University of Pittsburgh's master's program, I'm familiar with their requirement, and it was 250 hours. So it's necessary to get into school, and definitely a good idea to become. In looking for jobs, some frequent questions that I came across was, well, how good are your hand tools skills? Because there's been a little bit of a shift where people are doing less internship hours and they have less exposure to all the different tools. So people have reported that new graduates have less hand tool skills than people who have been in the field, you know, previously.
Okay. So definitely working with your hands, that's a big life skill.
Yes,
right?
Every day.
And when you're learning in school, is this something that they're training? I mean, how to work better with your hands, how to utilize these. I got to be honest with you, what is a Troutman router? What does this object look like?
Yeah, so it's a very large spinning machine that
okay.
you put different, they call them arbors on, and they're essentially different sanding cones, but the arm to the router is probably 2 feet long, so you can get inside of devices to grind them, trim them. Yeah, it's a very large Dremel, if you're familiar with like a Dremel.
I sure am, yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're going to be getting that kind of training when you're in school on how to use the equipment. And, you know, there's also that other aspect of it too. And I guess that's something that necessarily can't be taught. It has to be something that you acquire over time. Big thing, people skills, right? You're going to be working with people. And sometimes in what I would say is one of the most emotional times of their life, you know, losing a limb. So I would imagine that, you know, people skills, really big part of it.
Yeah, huge part of it. Depending on how they lost their limb, sometimes people have elective amputations or surgeries that necessitate them now using a prosthesis. But either way, it's a pretty traumatic event. So in combination of providing them, you know, physical care, it's a huge mental thing to go through and support your patients through.
Absolutely. Do you see any particular trends as far as like reasons that people are losing limbs these days?
Yeah, so there is a lot of research that comes out every few years that documents it, but for a long time, the number one cause of a lower limb amputation has been from dysvascular disease. So they have poor blood flow, get a wound that then transforms to an infection, and then they have to amputate above or below the knee typically. So that's the number one reason. I would say then comes the trauma, so car accidents, things like that. For fingers and toes, the leading cause of amputation is lawnmower accidents.
Really?
So, yep, be careful out there with your lawnmowers. So that's along the lines of trauma. And with war, it's actually pretty surprising. We have very little amputations from war trauma, maybe 1 or 2% of all amputations in the United States are from war trauma. Yeah.
Wow. I know that one of the biggest things that surprised me was when I discovered the amount of technology that's now being integrated with all of these prosthetics. I mean, they've come a long way in just the last decade, you know, heck, even the last 15 to 20 years. We're now talking about computers being integrated with these prosthetics. That's something that just totally blew my mind. So I'm just gonna kind of let you take it away from there. So talk to me, what are some of these integrated technology breakthroughs that we're seeing nowadays in prosthetic limbs?
Sure. So yeah, the access to technology is kind of filtered in the field, unfortunately. You see these really cool things that the Department of Defense has come up with or manufacturers have come up with, and it takes a few years for it to actually trickle down to the average consumer or for a clinic like us. A big piece that holds us up is getting insurance coverage for this new technology. There's a big process of getting devices kind of verified, so that takes a little while until insurance is willing to cover it. They will not cover a device that's considered experimental.
Really?
Yeah. So that takes a little while, but some things that have made it kind of through all the hoops is, yeah, microprocessor technology. So microprocessor knees on the market, and they've been on the market for quite a few years, 20 plus years. And then now they've got some microprocessor feet, and both of those devices, all except for maybe one microprocessor knee, and I think there's two microprocessor feet on the market that are actually power assisted. All the other devices use hydraulic cylinders to monitor the terrain that the patient is on and adapt the stiffness essentially of the joint to accommodate for the terrain or to give the individual time to recover from a fall. So that's really cool. With all the, yeah, microprocessor technology is probably the leading edge that's most accessible to patients. On the clinician end, one really interesting thing that I get to work with pretty much daily is the new rise of kind of computer animated design, so CAD technology, if you've heard of CAD.
Yeah.
We use CAD for creating a lot of our prosthetic sockets. We can use the software to design the socket and then send it off to a 3D printer or a 3D carver to carve it without having to take casts and older school methods of obtaining the models. So that's cool. And there's also like 3D structure scanners where we can take kind of pictures of the person's limb
and create 3D models.
Yep, and it transforms it into that CAD software.
That is amazing. I mean, what you're describing to me, you're talking about adaptive technology that's helping not just this person's range of motion, but it's thinking, it's learning in many ways. And I'm glad that you brought up the insurance issue, because I mean, insurance is always an issue.
Yeah.
But it's almost kind of sad to hear that insurance doesn't kind of outwardly cover all of this. Is this kind of like a barrier that you're seeing in the industry, insurance not covering some of these more advanced, quote unquote, experimental limbs?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. There's a lot of hoops that amputees have to jump through. Mm. Different insurances are better than others. And there are some really good organizations out there that are pushing for insurance companies to increase their coverage, essentially. One thing right now that's really big that I'd like to put a plug in there for is for access to exercise prostheses. So insurance, as of now, New Mexico, with the help of an organization called AOPA, they have passed some legislation that requires some of their state-run insurances to cover some exercise prostheses. So we're trying to get more states to get that coverage, but as of now, exercise is out the window for an amputee. Insurance will cover a walking leg, but they won't cover any exercise devices. So that's one thing that we're really pushing for and I'm really passionate about. It's a little, the biggest comparison that I like to make is some insurance companies for able-bodied people will put on these big events for 5Ks, and they'll encourage exercise. They'll give you exercise trackers, and if you meet, you know, certain criteria for exercise, then they'll give you discounts on your insurance or things like that. But when it comes to an amputee who says, hey, you know, I exercised before my amputation, I want to exercise now, or hey, my unhealthy lifestyle has led to my amputation, I think I want to be more active post-amputation, an insurance says, hold up, that's not medically necessary.
Huh. We have some work to do, is what you're telling me.
Definitely. And there's great organizations. Again, AOPA is very helpful in pushing Congress to make some changes for that.
Well, hopefully we get every state and every insurance company to kind of get on board, you know, saying, hey, you know, that's why you're there. You know, when people are, you know, in a different physical state, keep me posted on those kinds of
things.
I would love to hear if there's any movement.
Sure.
So let's say I've got my master's and I've got my bachelor's and I've completed these 6 years of training here to be an orthotist and a prostheticist. Talk to me a little bit about the day in and day out. What does kind of like my life on the job look like? You know, that's kind of a question that I think a lot of people want to know. You know, what does my day-to-day look like? You know, what's kind of like my work-life balance? You know, am I on like 15 to 20 hour days? You know, do we get breaks? You know, those kinds of things. What is kind of my day-to-day look like?
Yeah, so the field's very diverse, kind of comparing it to nursing, you can get into a whole lot of different settings, hospital settings, VAs, private clinics like mine. There's corporate clinics out there. So everyone's looks a little different. But for me, coming from a privately owned company, we're open from 8 to 4, and we've got a lunch break from 12 to 1. We have our schedule arranged that we can potentially see patients on the hour, every hour, except for that lunch break.
Of course.
And the patients can range from a newborn. I have a one-year-old patient right now.
Wow.
All the way up to, I have a 96-year-old patient. So the patient variety really ranges with their devices. Again, prosthetics and orthotics, we see both in our clinic. So you could see a patient for initial evaluation, a follow-up, a repair, routine maintenance for those microprocessors.
Sure.
So a wide variety. And once someone has an amputation, they'll have to have a relationship with a prosthetist for the rest of their life. So you never know what you're going to be scheduled for the day. Part of that insurance piece is you have to have a lot of documentation for the field. So it is relatively note heavy after every appointment. I've got to document exactly what I did, why I did it, to get the work that I did paid for through insurance. Yeah.
I like what you said there, because really you're kind of forming lifelong relationships with these people. You kind of almost can't help but get to know them, it sounds like, and form kind of like that bond, because you make a great point. These patients, they end up becoming a part of your life too, because they kind of do. They need that lifelong, you know, connection.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's a very intimate relationship between a patient and their prosthetist or orthotist. Yeah.
Right. How many patients, on average would you say? Does it kind of depend on the day? I mean, you see 10, 12 patients a day?
Yeah, so our current office, we're trying to grow. So depending on the days of the week, and we have three practitioners in total, myself and two others. And depending on who's in the office on that certain day, it can be really busy or not so much. I would say on average, maybe I'll see, maybe anywhere from 4 to 8 patients a day. And the appointments are typically an hour long, but for a more complicated case, maybe we'll get a 2-hour slot or something like that.
Here's something I wanted to kind of ask, because when people think of like the fabrication process of an artificial limb, that can take some time, right? Depending upon how complicated. Just on average, about how long would you say it takes to actually have a prosthetic limb created?
Yeah, so there is one exception to this timeline, and I'll mention that at the end. But okay. Typically, we start with a casting appointment where we'll take a mold with either fiberglass or plaster of Paris of the person's residual limb. Once we get that, it goes back to the lab, and we have an in-house fabrication lab connected right on the back of our building. So everything we do happens in-house, so that helps with the timeline a little bit. But once we have the cast, we pour the cast full of liquid plaster of Paris, and then we have to modify it. So a residual limb can only tolerate pressure in certain spots, so we have to make reliefs and add more pressure and things like that. So we have to kind of clean up the model, and that could take a week maybe for it to get poured and the lab to process it. Then the patient will come back for what we call a test socket or a test walk. That socket is made out of just a clear diagnostic plastic that allows us to heat and flare it and mold it, so it's a little bit easier to work with initially to make sure we get the shape perfect. That insurance will allow us to do two of them to make sure that we get it just right. Those processes could take a week from each other. So once we get to the second test socket, maybe we're at 2 or 3 weeks in, and then we'll go to the final delivery, which our lab maybe turns around things within 7 to 10 days if everything is kind of normal.
Wow.
So maybe we're looking at 4 or 5 weeks for the whole process to pan out.
And taking your time, of course, you know, making sure everything, you know, fits well and all the components gel together. You know, that's an art form.
Yeah.
Into itself.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like where real quick, what are they constructed from? Thermoplastics, metals, steels, titanium, all yeah. the above? Or?
All the above, yeah. So the sockets are the main thing that is custom fabricated. So back to the insurance, for what we call a preparatory device, it's kind of just a training wheels initial socket someone will use right when their limb is first amputated, just for a few months. We expect a lot of changes to happen to the shape of their limb, so we don't want to use the more expensive and more expensive materials for the fast socket. That socket can be made out of a thermoplastic, or we can laminate it with epoxy resin, and then the layup of the lamination is comprised of fiberglass or nylon and cotton to get the thickness of the socket we need. Then for the definitive sockets, which are the more long-term ones, they're mainly made of carbon fiber. There's some new technology out there that is like a volcano rock, but it resembles carbon fiber, things like that, some sort of braided material along with those cotton and things like that. Then, so that's the socket, the materials of the socket. Then everything else is modular, so kind of like Lego, we can attach and build. It's an industry standard about the size and fitment of most of the modular components. So the prosthetic knees, they all have certain called pyramid tops or screw tops that we know will attach to how we've made the end of the socket. And then the feet and pylons and tube clamps and things like that, they're either stainless steel or titanium, and most prosthetic feet are some sort of fiberglass or carbon fiber.
So the materials really do kind of, they run the gamut, right? Depends yep. on what it is.
Yeah,
right?
It depends. It's kind of a running joke with a professor from the University of Pittsburgh's program. You ask him something and he says, well, it depends.
Well, there's no cookie cutter, right?
Definitely not.
Especially yep. for something like this, because this is all highly customized devices.
100% right? custom, right? Yeah. And then I wanted to touch back on that one point that I made about the typical process and the one exception.
Okay.
So the exception, there's this new technology out there from a company called Osher, and they have something called a direct socket. That eliminates the test sockets, and we actually make the limb or make the socket right on the limb. So the resin is a different type of resin. It's still a braided material, fiberglass or carbon, and you can make the socket right on the limb. So once you get your insurance approval and you get the parts ordered in, it's a 3 or 4 hour appointment to actually fabricate the whole thing.
Wow. And again, with once you get your insurance approval, right? That's the thing, right?
Always the holdup.
That's the magic trick sometimes, it sounds like. You've given me so much here, and so much of a larger world this is. And I think that this is something that not too many people all the time do they think about, because it's easy to take for granted, having, complete mobility. So let's say that I'm considering becoming this occupation. You're living and working the job. What do you tell me? What do you tell me, knowing what you know about the work? What's something, let's say that if I'm thinking about, making a transition to this career, if I'm in school even, and I'm looking to do this for my career, what are a few things that that you would want to impart to me?
Yeah, so back to that hand skills piece, as much as you can tinker around with things and build that knowledge of how things operate and how they put together. We have patients come in all the time with a creak or a squeak or a weird sound that's coming from it. And I could have my technician look at it, but they might be busy doing something. So it's on me to use my tools and use my skills and knowledge to figure out what the problem is. That hand skill piece is really important. You'll probably acquire most of the prerequisites for the master's program that will be beneficial education-wise. So the anatomies, the biomechanics, things like that probably will come included. If you do your research on the program that you want to get into, the master's program, you'll probably get the education-wise, but the hand tool skills is my biggest piece of advice. Yeah.
Hand tool skills.
Yes.
All right. Let me just ask this next question. This is something we're a big proponent of here at Hartford Community College: continuing education, workforce development, and training. And they say you never stop learning. And I'm getting a pretty good window of your job. And it sounds like there's always going to be these continual advancements and continual training. I mean, this might be a gimme, but tell me, it sounds like there really is continuing education, continuing training in this field, right?
Yeah. So new research comes out about different casting techniques and different biomechanics principles that you have to acquire and adapt with new research. So there's presentations every year through the academy, and they have these big annual meetings where they go through all the research. So that's a good one to attend and get a lot of information from. As well, the Board of Certification, ABC, American Board for Certification in Prosthetics and Orthotics, they're the ones who you do your testing through and get your credentials from. They require every few years that you get a certain amount of continuing education credits. If you are up to date with the technology and you're interested in the new technology that comes out, most manufacturers of the technology will say, hey, do you want to learn about our new microprocessor knee or whatever have you? And they'll offer continuing education credits for their courses. So if you're staying up to date with the new technology, you'll probably accumulate most of the continuing education credits that you need. Or you could go to the academy's meeting and learn about the research and get education credits there too.
It's the truth. You never stop learning, especially in this job, it sounds like. But
yes, definitely.
And it's a job, and just like any job, and I know, you know, students that are listening to this, they always want to know, how much am I going to make? You know, great occupation. You're helping people live better, be more mobile, more active throughout their lives.
Yeah.
So, and I'm going to ask this question now because I hear them in the back of my head asking, how much am I looking at, you know, maybe just starting out?
Sure. So I think a quick Google search would show you that, again, because of the insurance discrepancies state by state, it varies salaries state by state. But I think the national average kind of entry level, again, prosthetist, orthotist, if you've got both certifications, is somewhere around $75,000. And if you get, you know, 20 years of experience and you get experienced and notable in your field. There's additional certifications you can get, such as like a fellow of the academy. You'll get some extra letters behind your name. If you get those kind of things, people see salaries up into the $150,000. So
wow.
I would say, somewhere remotely in there.
You're helping people live better, and you can support yourself doing it, you know?
Yeah.
So sounds like a great profession to me. And for you, what's the biggest reward of doing this every day?
That's a tough one. We have patients who very frequently now that I'm able to see walk for the first time. That's pretty rewarding to see. Our company slogan is bringing people from disability to ability. So I think that kind of accurately captures the best part is seeing people get their life restored back.
And if I ever end up in that position, I'm going to be coming to see you. So
yes, thank you very much.
Olivia, before we break, are there any extra resources that you could maybe point students to for this career?
Sure. So the American Board for Certification has a really good website that they have created for people interested in the field. The website is www.whatispop.com. So what is POP? And that is prosthetics, orthotics, and podorthics. We didn't touch much about podorthics, but it's a small branch of the field for orthotics for lower limbs and feet.
I want to thank my guest, Olivia Slaughter from Real Life Prosthetics, for coming on to Career Explorers. Olivia, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Who knows? Maybe you've just found your next career move. Join us again on Career Explorers for more people living the job that you're looking for and give you that insider's glimpse. And please like and subscribe to all of WHFC's podcasts, Feedback, HCC 360, and this one, WHFC Presents. For Career Explorers, I'm Matt Terry. Until next time, stay curious, Hartford.